Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You remember the South Park episode that's sort of like the Wizard of Oz, and they have to follow the only paved road?
Follow the only paved
road. they pick up like a mime in Montreal, I think.
Yeah.
And I forget what the, like a fisherman from like Saskatchewan or something. I'd have to go find the episode.
Yeah, it would have to be out east, I think, fishermen. Yeah, they grow wheat and cows and sheep in Saskatchewan, just like, you know, plains for you guys, right? Mm-hmm. It's all flat. Mm-hmm. You know, you can watch dog run away for 3 days. Which is a classic old joke. All right. So hey everybody, welcome to episode 196 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined as usual by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And also by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
All right.
So one of these times, Tim, you have to say my name first.
Really? Just to mess people up?
You never say my name first.
No, I know. It's like, you know, we start, you
know, I know.
It's based on reverence, you know?
So it goes in ascending order, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. We could do it by age.
I mean, like, think about it. If you go pay for Taylor Swift concert tickets, she doesn't come up first, right? Like, clearly.
She doesn't? Oh, that's true. Yeah, the big act is, we're just the warm-up guys, really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I don't think he's buying it.
Nope. All right.
It's kind of like TV credits. Like, you know, when they show the credits for, or the beginning part of, like, you know, who's coming out of the show, you want to be, like, that first person or the last person. You don't want to be the people in between.
Well, see, he's not always the last guy, because sometimes we have Marin or we have Tammy or Greg or whatever on the show, and I usually bring them in last.
Right? That's true. All right. I'll let you off the hook.
But you're right. One of these times, I think, you know, maybe not next week. Well, maybe next week. I don't know. We'll have to surprise somebody with, you know, as usual, Mark Rubin, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or once again, joined by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California. And way over there, if we have to introduce him, Jaime Lopez Jr.
In the northwest of Toronto.
Yeah, and on TV shows, they often have, they list the whole cast and then the last person to say, and starring. And
that's true. No, that's what I mean. Like, you know, you get the pre-roll, you get the Ryan Reynolds, you know, and then so on. And then it says at the end, and, you know, Josh Brolin as Cable, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. It's funny that you mentioned that, because it's interesting to watch how big names are called out in, you know, movie trailer or movie title sequences, right? So they don't often put them at the front anymore, like thanks to George Lucas, right? But anyway, that's a story for another day. So, Jaime, do we have any Ask MTJC? He said, not knowing as we did.
We do. We have one from, I don't even know how to describe this, friend of the show and co-host of another show, Spotcast. That would be Jonathan Kuhline at JPK News. As a posting here on Twitter, it says, visited the at MTJC podcast headquarters of Tim Mitra, and all we got were these cool t-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure who X-Men, Sad Xavier, okay, got it, right, makes sense. These t-shirts look real nice, folks. If you haven't seen them, we will have the link for those of you driving at home, so that way you can acquire your own. They're snazzy.
Yeah, so X-Man's underscore 1664 is my grandson Xavier, so he needs followers, so follow him. All right, yeah. No, they picked up their t-shirts the other day when they were here, so in space gray, if you want to see what they look like.
They look sort of brownish in the picture. That must just be the light.
Yeah, that's gray. It's gray. Hmm. It's laurel. I'm telling you, it's laurel.
Okay. It's a challenging photo. Like, if you look at Jonathan's, I don't know, if you're looking at the Twitter website, you can see both the tweet that has his face, and you can also see Jonathan's profile picture, and you might not be, you know, able to tell that it's like the same person, because it certainly struck me at first. It's like, who's this person? Oh, it's Jonathan. Okay, got it.
Yeah, and plus we use the, you know, the incandescent version of the LEDs in the basement here, so they have that yellow cast to them, because they have a yellow dye on the LED, right? So it creates a sort of warmer, more, you know, style of the lighting, and gray is one of those funny colors. It can either look warm, which is what it looks like here. It looks like it's got more magenta in it, or it can look cool with a little more gray in it, right? So it's funny. I had a gray scarf. I've lost it since, but when in the house, it always looked brown, but when I was outside, it always looked sort of bluish gray. So it's that, you know, the blue and yellow, blue and white dress controversy all over again, right? Or as I like to say, perception is 9/10 of the law. All right. So, yep. If you want to see what the t-shirts look like, there they are on, supported by these two models. What's our other Ask MTJC there, Jaime?
Oh, you're going to have me read this one. Okay, sure.
Oh, sorry. So, this is for me, right?
Yeah, this is from at Tim Mitra.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Did we talk about the symbol on the command key, the little, like, propeller blade?
So, I can't remember. I think this is a Susan Kerr reference, too, because I'm pretty sure she designed this icon. And I've been looking at it for years myself, you know, kind of wondering what the heck. It's kind of like a double infinity thing. What do you guys think it is? You know what it is?
I don't know.
A little squiggle on the command key?
I have no idea.
Okay, imagine a castle with four turrets and you're looking at it from above.
Okay.
So it's sort of meant to be like a secure key, as a, you know, implies security as well as, you know, special things you could do kind of thing, right? So that's to be like a little castle. Weird, eh?
Yeah.
When did they have the little Mac logo on, or sorry, the little Apple logo on the
Oh, that was on keyboard. The keyboards up until around, I have a pile of dead Macs here.
I kind of remember seeing those on sort of beige-ish boxes.
Well, to this day, I still call it the Apple key, and people look at me like I've got three heads, and then I kind of go, oh, sorry, the command key. Right, because it had the Apple key on it forever. I mean, that came over from, I think Lisa might even had an Apple key, and obviously the Apple II and the original Macs had the Apple key as well, right? So I can't remember when they took it off. It was probably about the time they went to these flat, you know, aluminum keyboards, sometime around the G4, I think G4 era. It was before, pretty sure it was before Classic came, or before Classic ended and OS X came out, right? So I guess that's another follow up question. Way to go, I mean, just write.
It's a good thing we don't have fact checking on this show, because it would, like, the whole next show would be nothing but fact check.
I'm sure Greg is yelling at his keyboard already.
That's true. You heard the show and he's yelling at it. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So I found an article called The Untold Story of Why the Command Key Replaced the Apple Key on Your Mac.
Oh, perfect.
Let me post that in the notes so we can all get it.
The Untold Story of Why the Command Key Replaced your Apple Key. Drumroll, please.
And let's see.
Dig in. Real-time follow-up, folks.
So Steve Jobs said one day, "You guys are taking the logo in vain. There's too many apples on the screen. Get rid of it." Doesn't say when that was.
Surprise. There's a video here by Susan Kerr attached to this thing. Cool. Yeah, and I think in that 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whenever I had her her video in there, where she was talking at Layers conference, I think she talked about a number of work that she did for other ones, and it looks like this video is says here another one, a full video of Kerr explaining her work at Apple and other companies. So last week we talked about her work at on the Windows stuff, right? She found a Swedish symbol. Oh, this is what it is. Pinpoint interest places, but it kind of looks like a castle. I do remember her telling this part about the Swedish symbol that is reminiscent. I think that it's reminiscent.
But it does say the resemblance to a castle seen from above is purely coincidental.
Oh, really?
I feel like this is another one of those things coming out of Apple's history and legacy that has all these weird myths and legends where there's several different versions of the same story.
Yeah. No, I do remember her saying this about the Swedish symbol, because she showed a picture in her slide deck of being in Sweden and seeing like a sign directing to a campground with that symbol on it. And she thought it was cool that, you know, there's a symbol that she saw years and years before. So I guess I was wrong. Oh, well, maybe we don't have fact check on this show, eh, Jaime?
Real time fact check. We just did it.
So what I was going to say was that Joe Triplinski, our fan of the show and host of the release notes, replied to me about, I guess he was listening to the show this morning and replied to me about, mentioned last week, I was trying to remember who who the person that came over from with retail experience to, as he says here, spearheaded the original app stores. And that was Ron Johnson, who was originally from Target, was one of the, he says, the unsung heroes of Apple's rise to world domination. So that was sent to me by Joe just a few hours ago. And what else we got?
There you go.
Yep, now you know. Tommy, you have the next one, I think.
Yeah, this one is, I can't even use it myself because I checked and it didn't show up for me. But apparently Apple users in the European Union can now download all the info that Apple has about you. You can, as you would expect for the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulations that are going around, you can obtain a copy of your data, you can correct it and deactivate your account or delete your account. And I guess from what I've seen, it's supposedly, this is supposed to be rolling out to presumably everybody.
Yes, it is everybody.
Yeah, but it's starting in the EU first, which kind of makes sense because as we record this, we are a great 2 days from the May 25th sort of deadline from where you either should have had a plan or you need to have implemented stuff. I forget what the actual regulations themselves say, but yeah, this is kind of interesting. I want to try this out when it becomes available and see what sort of things Apple has on me. They offer multiple file sizes as types of ways to download your stuff in chunks, I would guess, of 1 gig, 2 gig, 5 gig, 10 gig, or 25 gigabyte chunks.
Well, there's another article here on this same page, which talks about Apple's 7-nanometer A12 processor are ready to go into production. So we're currently on an A11, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought current devices on 10-nanometer? Does it say in the article?
I don't know. Ask the chip guy. Don't ask me.
I don't know.
Oh, there you go. Apple's A11 Bionic and Qualcomm Snapdragon 845 are made with a 10-nanometer process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
7 nanometers is pretty damn small.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it wasn't. It really wasn't.
The nanometer is 10 angstroms, and an angstrom is roughly the diameter of a single atom. So
really?
Yeah. So that means that the active area of these, well, it's not really the transistors these days, but it's usually the metal pitch is only about 70 atoms wide. Pretty wow. Amazing. Pretty amazing
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that long ago that you would see like the Intels and AMDs of the world talking about their processes that were measured in micrometers.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember. People used to say there's no way we could ever scale below 1 micron. You know, it's a micron is a micrometer. And now we're 10 times that small. It's amazing.
Hmm.
Unbelievable. More than 10. It's 100 times smaller.
All right. Yeah, I think this is a quick one I found when I was poking around the interwebs earlier today that Apple, this is an article, I guess an opinion piece here from Quartz about how Apple, Apple focuses on the watch being something for health and you know, various other things. There's 23% of the U.S. labor force are people who are on their feet all day in retail operations, you know, cooks and cleaners and what have you, people who can't reach into their pocket and pull out their phone all day long. And so the watch itself, you know, as a second display for the phone becomes a huge piece for people doing, you know, in working in industries where they're working with their hands and stuff like that, and they can't, you know, don't have access to that kind of stuff. So this is an opinion here on how, you know, airline attendants, bartenders, waiters, baristas, shop owners, you know, TSA employees who can't, you know, reach into their pocket and pull out their own phones are able to take advantage of that. And I think I talked about one of my friends is a dog walker up at the park where Mac runs around and like a fool. And she, you know, when I told her about the Apple Watch, she got one and she loves it. She's actually got, the last time I ran into her, she's onto her second or third one. She just finds it great because she can, you know, she's got like 8 dogs on a leash and she can still manage to communicate with people using her watch alone, right? Just a quick little piece there.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we see new stuff for watchOS, presumably watchOS 5 at WWDC. And I'm hoping we'll see something that will let us build more, you know, I don't want to call them interesting, more productive apps and less sort of passively consuming notifications, which is by far the biggest thing I use them for. And that's sort of what this article is focusing on. But I think it's really hit its stride. Like this article mentions the Apple Watch Series 3 starting at $329. I seriously doubt that's what people are wearing. I think the vast majority are going to be using those much cheaper, like,
The two,
$269, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or even like I even know some people who bought like the 38 millimeter because, you know, that $50 makes a difference, right?
Yeah, and you don't really shave off that much off the size anyways. And if you want a physically smaller watch, which I guess some people would, it's certainly fashion-wise, it seems like larger watches in general are the fashion of the day, I guess. And it's sort of weird to think about people still believing the Apple Watch is like big and clunky. And then you watch Google I/O's presentation and everybody's wearing these, I think they're Motorola or similar Android Wear watches. And it looks like they have like either a beer can or a can of tuna on their wrist. It's ridiculously large.
Yeah, chewing tobacco. tobacco, right?
They got their snuff right there for easy access, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Hmm. Yeah, well, that's what happens when you go around, I guess. Yeah, so what's next? The next story is Mark, I guess, right?
Yeah, so we've been talking for a couple of years now about Apple and their interest or attempts to make self-driving cars or just get into the car market in general. And it's always been sort of shrouded in mystery what's going on. And we know that there are some out on the streets that you see, but not a lot of details of what's actually happening. Well, the New York Times put out an article today, which has a little bit of interesting information. Apparently, Apple's been trying to find a partnership with a couple of car makers like BMW and Mercedes, and it seems like we're turned down by them. So they've made a deal with Volkswagen to convert some of their new Volkswagen's T6 transporter vans into, turns out, self-driving shuttles for Apple employees to shuttle them back and forth between the different campuses. It's kind of an interesting twist on the whole thing.
So
this just came out today. So hot news. It's not a super lot of information in these articles, but in the New York Times article, but it is kind of interesting. They're saying that this has been going on. Let's see. It doesn't say how long it's been going on, but this definitely replaces the effort that was going on here a couple of years ago here in Silicon Valley, where they were planning to build an R&D lab. They never did that, but they're doing this partnership instead. Now, supposedly it was supposed to be done by the end of this year, but it looks like that deadline is not going to happen, according to a source here. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. So we'll have to keep an eye out for that, whether we start seeing Volkswagen buses driving Apple employees around town.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, it's kind of a short circuit, really, because in terms of, you know, how you go from Infinity Loop to Apple Park, right? It's kind of, you know, a couple of roads you can take, a couple of routes, right? And I think if a car, a self-driving car, was doing the same route every day, it would kind of, you know, it could learn a lot about that particular route, right?
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah.
You know, yep. It's funny because, you know, in terms of self-driving technologies, I mean, Vancouver has had, they have a light transit that runs on a rail, and admittedly, I realize it's a rail service, but it's like a what do they call it now? I forget what they call it. This has a name. I'll look it up and I'll put it in show notes. But since 86, the Expo 86 that they held in Vancouver, they've had this self-driving train system, you know, that has no attendant on it. And, you know, people have been shuttling around Vancouver for eons, you know, since that time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like the technology is not there to be able to kind of deal with, you know, this stuff and, you know, people, you know, shuttling people back and forth and stuff like that.
Well, it's a whole lot harder to have cars driving on regular roads than it
is. No, and that's what I mean. That's not about admittedly closed loop. That it's a monorail, you know. So right. I mean, it's not like you can go off the rails, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. But it's been running for eons. But I mean, like, you know, from the point of view of like how unpredictable human beings can be getting on and off of things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like all the subway systems we have here in Toronto, and I know in New York, and pretty sure they have. Yeah, I think I saw them in Washington as well. There's always an attendant who has to be in the middle of the train that sort of, you know, watch for people running, getting on and off the trains to make sure that the doors don't close on people and stuff like that, right? So, and it makes sense. Like, I think most of the big campuses down there, like Facebook, you know, you don't park on, you go to visit Facebook, you don't park in Facebook, you park like in one of the parking lots on the outskirts and you get shuttled in by a driver, you know, onto campus.
Actually, right? At Facebook, they have valet parking that you pretty much have to use. You can't just park your own car. You pull into their giant lot and valet there who takes your car and parks it somewhere.
Oh, really? Well, when I went there, I just found a little spot to park my car and then went to the local, you know, nearby shuttle stop and shuttled me in. Yeah, I guess it was just a small one, but it crossed the highway, you know, the big highway you were talking about the other day, the number one, I guess, or whatever.
That's the 101.
101, yeah. So I parked on the opposite side from where Facebook campus was.
All right, that's
shuttled across the way, right?
Yeah. Or maybe it's 84, depending on, well, who knows?
I don't know. There were a lot of cars on it and it went fast.
Yep.
Anyway, but yeah, just the point was about getting shuttled. But I mean, like, that would be a case there where you could also, it would be the same route that the you know, the shuttle would be taking, driven by a human being, could be replaced by a self-driving car that would get used to the traffic.
You could take De Anza all the way up to Homestead and cut all the way across, or get onto 280 freeway, get off at Wolf, or take Stevens Creek over to Wolf. Okay, I'm an episode of The Californians now.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. The scary part is I knew exactly what you were talking
about. Yeah, I
knew
you did. Yeah. I was doing that on purpose.
Too much visiting of Apple. So, Jaime, why don't you take this one, this next story on the music. musical device from Apple.
Yeah, a couple different stories. This one we're going to look at from 9-5 Mac, that Strategy Analytics came out with a report covering the smart speaker market during the Q1 of 2018. And the claim here is that Apple shipped, and shipped is different than sold, shipped just over 500,000 HomePods. That would be 600,000-ish in the quarter, which apparently comes out to about 10% in terms of market share compared to market leader Amazon at like 43.6, Google increasing up to 26.5, and then apparently the number three is surprising to me. I didn't realize that Alibaba's speaker was ranked so high. So a couple different things coming out of this report. I mean, for me, you know, the HomePod wasn't even out for all of the quarter. It came out sometime in February, at first or second week of February, I think. And, you know, it's a much more expensive device. I do think it was a pretty big mess by Apple to have to delay the device's release until February and critically miss the holiday season. So this article mentions about the possibility of a lower priced model coming out, which I would not expect at WWDC. And if it does in fact come out, I would think it'd come out in September, October, just in time for this holidays. And I think they can help catch up with some of the market share there. I mean, but let's be honest, if you're comparing a device that starts at $349 US to ones that start at $49, you do the math, which one is going to sell more? I don't think it's all about necessarily selling more. If you look at what Apple has sort of traditionally done with, let's say, like smartphones, they come out with the, hey, here's an even more expensive phone. Guess what? We have even a larger percentage of the profits. And if you're using a HomePod, like, and you're not somehow, you know, subscribing to Apple Music with it, you're kind of missing out on half the point of it. So if they can convince you to buy a HomePod because you believe it's great as a music source, right, as a speaker, maybe you kind of wanted to try it as, well, maybe I can do, you know, kitchen timers and other things, or use it for home automation. And then you say, you know what, I'm kind of missing out. I'm going to, you know, upsell or cross-sell myself into, you know, a $9.99, yeah, like, let's call it $10 a month Apple Music subscription. Like, that's just better and better with everything, right? Like, I think this is where it's not necessary that Apple, in my mind, necessarily has the biggest market share on this, but it definitely does need to make sure it maintains some market share. And as I was saying in the pre-show, I really want to see them have a really good, solid developer story for this to make it exciting for us to build for it, and therefore a virtuous cycle for people to want to buy, oh, I want to get the Apple HomePod because it does X, Y, and Z.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's interesting, I guess, that both of these authors sort of take the same angle on that report. I guess they must have, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 9-5 Mac is a little bit more, you know, just the facts, and the Verge article is a little bit more talking about and sort of like the downside of things of, like, you know, HomePod's kind of off to a slower start than you would expect. And
right.
But for me, I'm like, well, you missed the holiday season and it's more expensive to begin with, and you cut out critical features like AirPlay 2 and other bits to meet the shipping date, the already delayed shipping date. Like, yeah, it didn't really come out with the best foot forward. But I think just similar to the Amazon Echo that started out sort of slow, and then people saw them in other people's homes, I think it has more of a viral aspect to it. So I'd expect it to get more popular as more people encounter other people in their lives who have them and say, holy smokes, that sounds great. I want to get one of those too.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen Simon Sinek's talk on, and we talked about it a number of times, there's the Start With Why piece, but he does one where he talks about this bell curve and the early adopters. He says you can fall out of bed and sell the first 10 to 15% of any market because your early adopters are just going to buy it because it's shiny and got an Apple on it, right? And it's getting into that next sort of, you know, 20% or so that is the challenge. And I mean, so like you look at the numbers here, you know, Apple's already got 10% of the market according to this report. So that's a good sign that, you know, that's a sign that people are going to buy, people who would have bought it anyway have bought their devices, right? And again, it's only in the US right now, right? Like we don't have it here in Canada. I do know a few people in Canada who've, you know, made the drive down to Buffalo or visited the States, and they're all happy with the HomePod. They all speak really highly of it, right? So be interesting to see what happens once it starts to grow a bit more hype, right? And I think bringing out a second model obviously is going to raise people's interest in, you know, the first one or even the second one, right?
Yeah, similar to what we talked about with the Apple Watch, where I don't believe there's a lot of people buying the 42 millimeter most expensive Series 3. They're probably buying the, holy smokes, this is like $269 or $169, whatever it is for the cheapest Apple Watch that they offer now. And they get their feet wet, and if they decide they like it, maybe they upgrade for subsequent versions.
And I don't know if it's the industry that I'm in or the location I'm in, but you know, I see more and more Apple Watches every day. Like, you know, I'm surprised at how often I see them, and I even see the ones with little red dots on them, which mean that people bought the Wi-Fi one, right? So
the LTE one, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, LTE, that's what I meant. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So that in itself is an interesting thing. Or you see the ones, you know, with the stainless steel body, and you know people bought them not just because, I mean, you know if you look at practicality and you kind of go, you know, feature to feature, there's no difference other than aesthetics from one to the other, right? So it's interesting to see what people's choices are, and they'll spend the extra bucks to get the nice shiny, you know, stainless steel one, right?
Indeed.
Although that ceramic one looks pretty cool. All right. Again, Carol left a story out for me this morning. It was a report out of USA Today. It was picked up by the Toronto Stars, you know, newspapers do, that there's a couple of tricks, and I tried this myself with Siri this morning and I couldn't get it to do it, but apparently Siri has a few things up her sleeve, as it were, coming out at WWDC is what the prediction is, that if you ask Siri what's going on. I asked her to tell me about WWDC conference, and she just matter of fact told me it was like, you know, happening in June 4th to 8th in San Jose, and you know, that's it. But in this article here, apparently Siri may tell you, you know, things like, I'm going to have a shiny new home, and, well, not really shiny, more meshy and matte, which sounds like networking kind of stuff.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Did they not update Siri? Because that sounds like something it would have said for last year when the HomePod was going to be announced.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's true.
Because it has that sort of a matte finish, and it has a mesh around the speaker.
That's true. Now you say that. Yeah. This came out, this is released, this is May 22nd, 2018, which is, we're recording on the 23rd. And, or La 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 Siri is getting a brand new voice. Did we get a brand new voice last year from Siri?
We did. Remember they had the machine learning blog post that we talked about where they said, oh, this is how we made the sub phonemes. This needs a fact check for sure. It's like,
no, wait a minute. What? Yeah, why would they publish this today? And I saw this in a few other places too. Very strange.
Well, does Siri even have the right date for WWDC when you ask it?
Yes, she does.
Okay, so that's good.
No, I mean, this didn't work for me. Like I said, she just parroted out what's happening here. I'm just going to look at this.
Siri, tell me about the WWDC conference. I'm trying it. Didn't work. Hold on.
You're not listening to you. She's not talking to you anymore?
Yeah. Siri, tell me about WWDC.
Apple's 2018 Worldwide Developers Conference will be held at the McEnery Convention Center in San Jose, California, from June 4th through June 8th.
Well, I knew that already.
All right. Well, that's exactly what she said to me this morning, but I just wonder why would they publish this article today?
Well, so here's the thing. What if it did, in fact... Okay, what time was this article posted?
Wait, is this fake news? What's going on?
No, but like, imagine this. So imagine that it has not been updated. Siri has not been updated. People try out this stuff because we're getting close to dub-dub. They're like, what is this? News articles like this one in the Star come out. Somebody at Apple wakes up. They're having their, you know, breakfast burrito and some coffee. And they say, oh, no, did nobody decommission that? We need to go patch that software so it doesn't say that anymore. And now it doesn't say it. So it was true in time.
Yeah, that's kind of like what I mean. I was sort of saying, I think it's, yeah, here's another article today. Same story from USA Today this time, from the same author, same word for word, same thing.
Yeah,
at least the original source.
USA Today, Jefferson Graham, published at 7:41 p.m. May 21st, 2018, and then updated, you know, yesterday, May 22nd.
I mean, it's a web service underneath the covers, right? So it's not as if, you know, if like iOS 11 itself tells you something, it's like, oh, like that's going to be broken until the next point release comes out, right? This is the sort of thing they can just change once it comes to their attention.
Yeah, and then they recap what happened to Siri along the way, you know, being introduced in 2011, and then 2013 gets a new interface, new smoother voice. 2014, hands-free operation from the phones by saying, hey, Siri. Apologies to listeners. More proactive answers and questions. And then 2016.
I looked up the actual original article on USA Today's website, and it says, corrections and clarifications. An earlier version of this story indicated Siri's answers pertain to WWDC 2018. They were from last year.
So the responses were related to last year's WWDC, but they were asked today, though, right?
Not clear.
So that clarification needs clarification. Yeah, I'm still unclear what actually happened here.
So can you post that in the show notes there, Mark?
Yep.
So I can look at it?
Well, we've run into this with assistants before. Like,
listen to this podcast anyway.
Like both the Amazon Echo and the Google Home have been very frustrating, or like right around the time that I'd say like a sports season comes to end, and you'd be like, oh, you know, who's the current NBA? You know, sorry, when are the NBA finals? Right, and for a very long period of time, we'd be like, oh, you know, oh my gosh, I don't even remember who won last year's NBA finals. Was it the Cavaliers? Yes, right. Boy, we need to fact check. Let's pretend it's the Cavaliers, because if not, it was the Golden State Warriors. You know, well, you know, Golden State Warriors, you know, were defeated defeated by the Cavaliers, or the Cavaliers defeated, you know, such and such. I'm like, no, I want to know when the next one is, right? Like, that's really my intent was, but it hasn't been updated for that sort of case. I'm guessing that's what happened here.
The article says, Apple did not respond to a request for comment on Siri's plans Monday, but on Tuesday, Apple said those would-be Siri teases were from a year ago. It's removed the teases and instead swapped them with a terse directive to get all the details about Apple's 2018 WWDC at apple.com.
So they were responding with the wrong thing.
Yeah, they were using last year's data and then fixed it when they
found. Okay, so the story, so the story isn't that we're reporting on stuff that was available last year. The story is that Siri was responding with stale information.
Exactly.
Right. And real-time follow-up, the Golden State Warriors are the 2017 NBA champs. And I got confused because it's been the Warriors and the Cavaliers for the last 3 years, and it probably will be them this year too, so... Apologies for getting that incorrect.
Well, unlikely that that the Cavaliers will make the championship this year, since the Celtics are now leading 3-2 as of today.
Oh, see, I missed that one.
Yeah, game just ended maybe 15 minutes ago.
Okay, go Boston.
Probably by the time people hear the show, the series will be over, though. That's kind of interesting. Hmm. Maybe not.
So what have we learned by this, about this Siri kerfuffle?
One, similar to many things in software, and I've certainly run across this, where let's say you have something that's like a feature flag or an experiment of some sort.
Sure.
And everybody's really excited to get that experiment up for your pilot group, and then they're excited to make it generally available. Nobody ever remembers to turn stuff off. Make it a basic part of the code, or say, we really didn't want that anymore, let's get rid of it. It sort of just languishes. So the life cycle of these sorts of things, A-B tests all sure. do the same thing. Like, you know, if you're going to do this sort of time-based thing, you probably should have like a calendar reminder to remind you to remove it.
Well, so it probably was set to start to run like the last week of May, just before WWDC, to drive it some interest, right? And as we said last week and the week before, dates are hard.
Yeah.
Right. So people forgot to put the year in there, right?
Somebody wasn't using NS calendar. They were just straight up doing math on the raw NS date.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Poor people. Oh, well. Okay. Well, I guess we'll move on to some actual stories, if we have any left. This is an interesting one. So I posted this. It has nothing to do with any of this stuff that we're talking about, but it does have to do with security and updates and stuff like that. And it's a piece that was posted on Quora.com. The question is, what is the most sophisticated piece of software ever written? And the author of this article talks about this particular virus that came out, I think it was around 10 years ago, that, you know, was spread by USB sticks, where people stick in USB sticks in their PCs. And as soon as it copies itself over to your PC and installs itself. And then it tries to launch itself three different ways. And at the time, it used two of the ways that it was using weren't even known about as Windows vulnerabilities, right? And then once it's installed, it tries to get admin access. And again, it was using more ways that weren't known about. And you know, just the act of doing those kind of things, you know, 10 years ago was pretty sophisticated. And the next thing it did was it covered up its tracks. So it would go through and sort of remove all the references to itself. So if you even looked on the disk where it was originally installed, it wouldn't be there, kind of thing. And then next thing it tried to do was get internet access. And if it got internet access, it would access two servers, one in Malaysia, one in Denmark, one of those two, and update itself, like update the code, right? And of course, you know, any subsequent USB sticks you stuck in the machine would copy, you'd get new fresh copies of this thing and it would start spreading itself elsewhere. This is basically a worm we're talking about, right? And then it even signed itself with some certificates from real certificate providers, but without those providers even realizing that it had done this thing. But what was interesting about it was it just kept going on and on and getting more sophisticated in terms of how it was able to exploit the whole Windows PC kind of thing. And eventually it targeted centrifuges, right? And it looked for particular types of motors made by Siemens, right? And it would infect these motors and it would spin them up like faster or slower than you know, was safe. In fact, if it wanted to, it could spin the motors to the point where they would actually explode and, you know, crack and have bits flying across the room kind of thing and taking out people if they wanted. But they didn't do that. They sped it up just a little bit or slowed it down just a little bit but it would change the reporting of the speed of the motor in such a way that it would appear, you know, like in Mission Impossible, where, you know, you have the video camera and they put the false image in front of the video camera so it doesn't look like Tom Cruise is running down the hallway kind of thing. So it would do the same sort of thing. It would fake the reporting of the speed of the motor to look like it was running within spec, right? And what it was doing was targeting targeting centrifuges that were used in the purification of uranium in Iran, right? So it was an exploit, a worm that was exploiting, trying to stop the production of nuclear weapons in Iran. Isn't that a pretty sophisticated piece of software?
Yeah, it goes through a lot of hoops to do, you know, a very targeted sort of thing, and in a way that would be difficult to notice that something was happening, which is, I think, the most insidious thing. Like, it sucks if you get some ransomware and it's like, hey, we've encrypted your hard drive. Like, sucks to be you. Give me some bitcoins, right? But that's like, at least that's in your face, and you can know that there is a problem, and you can mitigate it in some way. And hopefully you've got time machine backups or something that you can deal with.
Right.
But something that you don't even know that you're owned, like, that's the worst possible one to me.
Yeah, this is the Stuxnet worm, by the way, in case you're wondering what the name of the worm was. But yeah, and it was, I mean, amazingly targeted thing, and it apparently affected like gazillion computers around the world. There's a chart here on this article. Oh no, where was the article? Oh, if you click on the link here and go to the semantic.com site, there's a chart that shows the infected machines, where they're located. And if you look at the infected hosts, over 60,000 infected hosts were in Iran alone. Over 10,000 in Indonesia, and then minimal the rest of the countries around the world. The U.S. was, a couple of 3,000, it looks like here, according to this chart, right? So amazingly targeted piece of software that was specifically looking for centrifuges being run in Iran. Weird, eh?
Yeah, it's kind of a more modern version of something that's, I don't know if it actually happens, so I apologize if it was like the plot to a movie or something, but something I heard many moons ago is that during the 1980s, during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, allegedly, the U.S. government had figured out that the Soviets were getting some sort of like heavy machinery, like industrial type machinery that wasn't supposed to be accessible to them, but similar to the ZTE phone things, where like somebody sold to somebody else, which then ultimately, illegally exported American technology to people who were on do not purchase lists or do not sell lists.
Right.
And this sort of machinery, industrial machinery, was programmable in some sort of way. So the spooks got in and added some sort of software that would, at some random point, cause the machinery to go wild and catastrophically destroy itself and probably cause a really big ruckus, to say the least, at whatever factory it was that was happening. And supposedly this actually did happen and shut down like an oil refinery or something in the Soviet Union.
That's not similar to this, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so it wouldn't surprise me if this sort of thing was still going on, and it's sort of this cat and mouse game, because it's kind of a nice way, right? Like it's hard to pinpoint like who exactly is responsible for this. What are you going to do? Say, hey, how dare you put this this worm on this technology I'm not supposed to have, right? Like there's no way to do the publicity, the public relations sort of side of this. It's very sort of sneaky and insidious, but the engineering side of it is really interesting and cool to see. Like, how do you even test out this sort of thing, right? Yeah. How do you just wing it and hope it makes it through?
Sure. Have you ever heard of the cuckoo's egg? Have you ever heard of Clifford Stahl? Have you heard of him?
Nope.
So the cuckoo's egg is an interesting story about a Unix exploit that happened back in the early mainframe days. I guess it might have not even been Unix, right? But Clifford Stahl was a guy who was was interested in computers and stuff like that. And he got, I think it was at Berkeley or somewhere like that, he got this job because you wanted to get computer time, which is what the thing was. And so by either working as or volunteering to work on these systems and manage logs and look at things and just keep an eye on the systems, he could trade that for computer time, right? And so one day he was there and he noticed this one particular entry in the log of this particular university professor who logged in at like some really odd time, like 2:30 in the morning, when nobody was in the university. And he just thought that was really weird. He kind of mentioned it to his supervisor or whatever, and like I said, well, just keep an eye on it, let's see what happens. And it kept happening, and it would be odd times. It would always be like, in the wee hours of the morning. And then so he was curious about it, so he looked up this professor's ID, and he went and found out that the professor was actually on a sabbatical and hadn't been on campus in 2 years or something like that, right? And so he started following this thing and he started tracing it back. And this is back in the early days when you connected by telephone modem, like the handset and the acoustic couplers and all that kind of stuff, right? And he started talking, investigating, and eventually got on to the police and then the FBI and stuff like that, trying to figure out where this person was coming from that was coming in and using the computer time, trying to break into the I guess this would be an early internet too, right? And it turned out that after he investigated, it's a great book, like goes on for months and months and months, and eventually he finds out that it's somebody in Europe, like Germany or something like that, has been using this exploit to try and get into this computer in the States, right? And how they figure that out was a command would get executed, and then there would be a pause, right? And then another command would get executed, as if, you know, somebody was, you know, entering some stuff, waiting for feedback on their monitor, and then reacting to that feedback. And so they figured out, based on the amount of time it took for the signal to go from the between commands, that they, you know, based on telephone technology at the time, they figured out where in, like, how far in Europe or how far around the world away this guy would have had to have been, right? And then they eventually arrested some guy in Germany that I think Interpol got involved, and they found this guy. So what he had done was that the piece of software he put in there is called a cuckoo's egg, and he would basically plant this piece of software into the mainframe the mainframe, and then it would basically wait until the system was rebooted, right? And then when it rebooted, it would initialize and create this backdoor for this guy, right? And that's where the whole idea, that's why the book is called the cuckoo's egg, because he planted this software that would, you know, basically exploit this thing. And Clifford Stahl ended up having this whole career as a computer consultant and lecturer and speaker and all that kind of stuff, simply because of this one particular little virus that he wrote about years and years ago. Or not virus, but exploit, right? I mean, that's called the cuckoo's egg.
Hmm.
Yeah. Early computer lore.
Yeah, I have to check it out.
Mm-hmm. I have a like a dog-eared version of it upstairs somewhere in a box. All right. So back to reality. So yeah. So the next piece is from me. One of the people I follow on, a colleague I worked with years and years ago, posts some interesting things on LinkedIn. And this particular link he put there this morning, I thought was really cool when I followed it. It's actually a link to I think we've talked about Apple's forays into social networking and blogging and all that kind of stuff. But in of particular interest to us, there's an entire series of these little 1 minute long podcasts that Apple does on Apple in Business. And it's got little episodes like, you know, how to use workflow automation, you know, the workflow software, or how to manage your Shopify store, how to collaborate with pages and numbers and things like that in documents. And if you follow this link and you go through the different categories that they have here, it opens up into iTunes on your Mac. There's a whole series of these little sound bites that Apple's producing. So I, you know, kind of how we kind of wondered what Apple's entry into podcasting was. It was last year they did the podcast studio, right? Was it last year?
I think it might have been last year. Yeah.
Or the year before. Anyway, just sort of interesting thing that Apple is taking advantage of this whole podcasting technology or podcasting, you know, interest to create these little tidbits for people. So, and of course, you know, part of their whole learning thing. And I followed it down a couple of little rabbit holes and found all kinds of different things. And they're like video podcasts. So there's some clips and stuff on that. Like they've got, you know, they obviously want to talk up their Apple in enterprise kind of stuff and connected restaurants. And, you know, it's there's tons of content that they've been putting out. You know, who knew until we pointed it out? Not many people, I guess, right?
Yeah, I had no idea this was here.
Yeah. And there's tons of content, you know, like, you know, Square's on here and, you know, a Shopify, workflow, which we mentioned already. Using video, you know, rail systems, Tokyo Metro, how Apple is basically out there doing its thing. And this whole series of tech talks and customer stories and things like that. Tons and tons of things in here. Oh, there's even that one about the, I think IBM, I wonder if this IBM stories are about their stuff we talked about before, where the people are choosing Macs as opposed to Windows machines, right?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Stuff on Cisco, Redlands Police Department use of Apple technology, you know, tons of stuff. You could get lost in here for days. I guess if you add up all the minutes, it's quite a couple of hours worth of stuff, right?
Yes.
There's one on Rogers O'Brien.
Who's that?
Isn't that your telecom company?
No, just Rogers. Oh. Somebody else. Yeah, Shopify. Well, friends of ours at our Taco, you know, work at Shopify. And by the way, Tulip was the name of the company I couldn't remember last week that I mentioned, a friend from who hosted our last Taco. I can't remember what they do now. I mean, I just thought it was kind of cool. These Apple podcasts that nobody seems to know about.
Yeah, FreshBooks is on there too. I know, because yeah. I scrolled over to see the more. I think workflow is one of those things we're going to have to keep an eye out for in our WWDC sort of predictions episode. Sure. Because I was just listening to another podcast today, and they made this weird offhand comment. They're like, oh, I guess it was just an acquihire, which, like, wait, hold on. they acquired the workflow folks like just before WWDC last year. It was really unreasonable to think, oh yeah, right, like, we'll just you know, slap a new logo on there and call it good. Apple workflow. I don't think that was going to happen. I think if you're going to see anything, this WWDC is going to be the one, right? Because they're not going to just integrate it into their software in 20 minutes. I mean, look at the other acquisitions like Bursley's Test Flight and how long that took to integrate into the mothership, though.
And Buddy Build too, right? Buddy Build's still going. People are still using Buddy Build.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine it won't be like instantaneous, like, oh yeah, like they're going to show something at WWDC that's Buddy Build related. Like, well, maybe, but it might also come later, right? It might be next year as they start integrating these things.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I just submitted 2 updates recently. Like, I did one a couple of nights ago, and I just did one just before the show here. I mean, like, you know, I'm about to record a podcast. You know, 2-3 years ago, I would never thought of uploading a build to Apple, you know, an hour before a podcast, right? Because, you know, you'd open up a whole can of worms when you did that. But it's amazing, like, now with this automatic signing and, you know, the stripping the Swift code and Bitcode and all that kind of stuff, it's amazing, like, how well this kind of stuff happens now, right? And these are just subtle updates that, you know, may or may not have come out of the whole Buddy Build acquisition. I don't know, right? So I never really, I played around with it a few times, but, you know, it's kind of like, I think Mark knows what I'm talking about. We used to pull our hair out literally, you know, 5-10 years ago when we were trying to upload stuff to the App Store, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now it's just seamless, right?
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I use Workflow all the time. I don't know about you guys, but I have a couple, I have one that if I want to remind myself, I use reminders, right, through Workflow. And I just basically, I have an at work one, I have an at home one. And so if I want to call, like, you know, an insurance guy or something that I want to do when I'm at work, I just, you know, hit this one and just enter in a couple of lines. And next thing you know, I get to work and my, you know, my phone goes, oh, don't forget to call the insurance guy kind of thing, right? So I use that all the time. And I'm sure there's tons more you can do with it than I'm even doing. Cool product. Anyway, so Jaime, you got something here for us about the App Store, speaking of which?
Yes, this is from Koivin's website, subtraction.com. And Tim, I thought you might like this one. It's a post focusing on illustrations in the App Store. So regardless of what you may think about, you know, the new App Store's design from a, you know, usability standpoint or how it impacts the haves and have-nots in the App Store, what we can all agree on is that these illustrations are freaking awesome. Like,
yeah,
the sort of editorial illustrations that they've commissioned, for lack of a better word, because I don't think these are all Apple employees necessarily creating these,
no.
Certainly on behalf of Apple, but the art style designs are so interesting. You've got like kind of a Hot Rod magazine sort of style for the cars. You have a, I don't know what to call this. Here we would call it colored pencil, but I think if that sounds vaguely racist to you, you can go with crayon pencil drawings. You've
Conti
got
sort of, crayon. It's Conti crayon. Yeah, yeah.
You've got like a, what is it? Super World of Gumball or Adventurous World of Gumball sort of thing. That's for the NBA
as well. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Kind of an Archie comic, like the more realistic Archie comics style. You've got like a New Yorker style. You've got a superhero style. They've got photos. They've got, I don't know what this art style is, but it's like a collage sort of thing. And
yeah, photo collage. Like, yeah. Photo montage, I would call that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like an incredible amount of different art styles that they're using to draw attention, even to the point where like this Serve Your Community one is, I assume that's hand drawn, you know, line art, like a pencil graphite sort of, or charcoal perhaps sort of drawings that are like, you know, photorealistic or at least, you know, very close to it.
Right. Yeah. No, it's cool. And it, there's a link at the very bottom of it. If you click on it, it goes to Pinterest.com. They've actually, this, I guess the author of this has made a board on Pinterest to these illustrations as well. I'm not sure if it's the same guy or not. His icon is a Batman, or Adam West in a cowl. Yeah, but, and he's got them all marked with a date, like April 2018 or May or whatever. Just all these different snapshots of all these different illustrative styles. It's interesting. You know, it's funny. I was just, a friend of mine across the street is an illustrator, and he was just talking about how it's tough to get gigs these days. And I wonder if this is a sort of open door here for people like that. But you're right. It's that, you know, popular mechanic style in some cases, and, you know, Archie comics. And like you mentioned, right, some of them are arty and, you know, sketch style, you know?
Yeah, but I'd like to see, seeing as I mentioned, the Hot Rod magazine or car magazine, I forget what it was. It was pretty big in the 1980s, where they had like a Rat Fink style of art that was pretty common for the, you know, the hand-drawn automobile-related comic strips inside.
Yeah. I'd like to see them. One of these is One Password, right? And it looks like this is a piece of artwork they would have supplied for the graphic, for the app of the day kind of thing, right? Because I know that when you get app of the day, you're asked to produce, or whenever you got featured, you're asked to produce some sort of artwork with that. So I don't know if you think Apple's curating this or maybe suggesting it or something, but people are setting up their own stuff.
Yeah, I guess it might vary. If it's a specific app like 1Password, as you mentioned there, 1.password7 just came out and was featured. I can imagine they probably ask, you know, the app in question to provide artwork. But I think for some of these that are more like, hey, here's this category of stuff you can do for Mother's Day, presumably that's Apple's own commissioned art.
True. Well, they do have a whole, every country, like Canada has an iTunes office, and I know that obviously they must have a big one down in the States as well, right? So, but you know, all the different stores around the world have some sort of people who basically choose what's going to be featured on their stores and so on and so forth. But you're right, it is interesting looking stuff. I hadn't really noticed it. I don't really spend much time on the App Store anymore. who finds apps that way?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point, isn't it? And I guess shadow pick of the day, because we're just about at the point of doing picks, I would guess 1Password7, but I have not tried it myself. I will update after the show.
Before the show, actually, too, yeah. Oh. It's pretty.
Has its own font face. Typeface.
Does it?
Yes. Oh. I forget what it's called, but as is pretty common for anybody who's getting large enough where the, you know, if you weren't using sort of standard system fonts, if you get to large enough scale, the pricing of the licensing fees get way too high. So Netflix came out with Netflix Sans, and Airbnb came out with Airbnb Serial, I think they called it.
Yeah.
A lot of companies are doing that because, you know, it costs a lot, and you have millions upon millions of users. It's better to just control your own destiny on that and have your own custom font that you don't have to pay licensing fees for. Then you can control, like, well, you know, is it optimized for screens? What kind of screens? You know, what sort of distance? Can it be used on billboards? So we don't have, like, yet another typeface and branding sort of thing for, you know, posters you might have in you know, Times Square and that sort of thing. So I don't know if 1Password is at that level, but it certainly seems to me that if they've got enough users, I mean, that's the sort of choice I might make too, right? Start with a nice like Helvetica variant and then sort of go from there.
So I'm looking at the we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about how to do attributions, right, on your apps. So this is the about screen on 1Password7 on macOS. Lovingly crafted by Agile Bits in Toronto, Lansing, St. Thomas, Ontario, Aurora, Piano, Texas, Peterborough, Ontario, San Francisco, and so on and so forth. Cupertino, they list a whole bunch of different places, and then they've got special thanks to and a bunch of people that they pulled out there. Coco HD Server, for instance, Flying Dolphin Studio, and a bunch of other people named in here. So I think I was looking for that. Is something here copyright 2011 Doosty LLC? I don't know who they are. I was looking to see if I could find the font name. Maybe they mentioned it here.
I found a news article that says Courier Prime Bits.
Oh, Bits. Okay, that makes sense. And then they've got a whole sort of software is provided for the copyright holders and contributors as is, expressed or implied, warranties, blah, 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 blah. You know, typical thing here. I think a few people were asking about where how do you do attribution? And here's an example of how they do it. Put it in an about screen with all this, you know, scrolling. All the people that pieces that they use, libraries that they use in the app, they've called out the individual developers and companies who've made them, so on and so forth. Cool. So, like I said, it does look good. I haven't really played around with it too much, but by the way, I did finally sign up for those of you following at home. I did eventually sign up for the online version of the 1Password a couple of weeks ago, and it was pretty seamless. It took like a couple of minutes for them to import. I remember you said when you first did it, Jaime, you had to move all your stuff over. For me, it was I took like maybe 10 minutes or not even to for them to sync my vault with their vault. So I'm still rocking two vaults though. Did you turn your local one off or
no? I'm afraid to. So my local vault has nothing in it, but because everything's been moved to the online vault.
Yeah.
It's because I'm unreasonably paranoid about, you know, any sort of weirdo bug if I delete that vault. So.
Yeah, me too. Like I'm still have my primary one on Dropbox, but the personal one that I've created now under my 1Password account is the one I'm doing new stuff in, right? But and you're right. So I have double entries because they're coming from both vaults. So I think you can turn one or the other off, right?
I don't even have double entries. There's a copy to vault, and then there's also a move to vault.
Right.
I think with a few of them, I experimented with copy, realized it was okay, so I moved them all. But I still have that other vault. It just sits there empty.
Yeah. Well, this is new. They've added this new. I'm just looking at some of the records here. It tells you right away as soon as you without even looking at the password, it tells you what the quality of your password is, whether it's good or fair or very good. And this, that one's very good. Okay. Shows you how, and then if you hit a site that's unsecure, like it doesn't use HTTPS or whatever, there's a banner that appears across the top. So, you know, without even delving into even using these things, it kind of shows, here's one of the weak passwords. I better fix that one up. Oh, no, this password is terrible. And not only weak, it's terrible. I got to look and see what this one is.
Is it it just password?
Oh my god.
Or yeah, 123?
This is one supplied to me by the people who run this website, and yeah, looking at the password, I can see why it's particularly weak. But
yeah, nothing gets me grumpier than, you know, I've got my settings that I prefer. I generally prefer to use passphrases.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a lot of websites support that. Be like, sorry, your thing has to include at least, you know, one number, one symbol, you know, capitalized thing. Like,
right.
But no, it doesn't need to. Oh, okay. Now that you've done that. Oh, by the way, did you know it has to be no more than 12 characters long? It's like, no, stop. Why are you doing that? Like, yeah. I'm not saying that I should be allowed to have a 1 gigabyte worth of content, you know, password. All right. You know, there should be some sane limits, but, you know, the 12 characters and these other sort of things that are legacy limits, like, let's do away with those if you can. Let's unrestrict it.
Yeah, it's funny, like, so with, for like the last year or so, I've just, you know, anytime I go to create a new account or whatever, I just get 1 password to create the password for me, you know? I don't even bother with even trying to figure something out myself, right?
Yeah, like when Twitter, I guess they didn't get owned, but they accidentally leaked out their, you know, passwords in some sort of internal logging mechanism. They're like, oh, maybe the interns can read it. You better change it. And it was right. Simple, incredibly simple. Just go change my password on Twitter using 1 password. Something similar-ish happened with GitHub too, right? I mean, why even think about it? That's literally in the name of their product, 1 password. That's all I have to remember.
Right,
that one could be really, you know, lengthy and difficult to type in because I don't normally have to do it that often. I do it, you know, once on my Mac. I use it often enough. It keeps alive.
Sure.
I use Face ID on my iPhone X. I use Touch ID on my iPad Pro. And yeah, it's just like, until we come up with a way to seamlessly, you know, eliminate passwords altogether, I say go use something like this.
Yeah. I did hear something actually, I think it was on Spark a couple of weeks ago, they were talking about some sort of web-based password now instead of, you know, having you enter in something. It's kind of, I guess, like similar to 1Password here. It's like an authentication token that you get from a site, and that's how you log into things. And that way you don't have to worry about remembering the thing. But again, I guess the question is, how would you do it if you're not online? But, you know, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, is this related to Mozilla, the Mozilla Foundation, makers of Firefox? I think they're involved in something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it was, but yeah. It's just interesting. It tells me that 2-factor authentication is available on this one particular site that I'm looking at. Yeah, well, it's generally cool, this stuff. They've now gone to like colored icons too, so when you look at the icons as you scroll through your, you can see whether it's just a password that you created at the time, or if it's like a, you know, branded logo, or just color-coded. Well, anyway, 1Password, good product. But yeah, that is a shadow pick. All right, anyway, so speaking of picks, I guess we should move on to our pick-rama. And I think, if I remember correctly, I'm going to get you to go first, Jaime. You have a pick?
Yes. Yeah, mine is a tweet by a friend of the show and also a fellow podcaster, Evan K. Stone. He runs iOS Dev Break, the iOS Dev Break podcast, I should say. And, right. You know, I didn't know this one. You'd mentioned that you do this all the time. So I think...
Yeah, Mark and I know this one, yeah.
Yeah, I think very similar to like some other evergreen topics. It sort of feels like if you wanted, you know, your thing in the conference talk world, literally could just keep doing, you know, nifty stuff. You could do an Xcode because Xcode is so massive that or like all these little switches and nozzles and buttons that you can tweak and deal with. I didn't know about this one. He says, today I learned you can load a file into the assistant editor in Xcode by doing an open quickly search with Shift Command O. Mm-hmm. And as an aside for me, that's something I do every day. I love that, right? I use that all the time. What I didn't know is the latter half, which is, and then alt clicking it when the file you want to open appears in the list will open up in the assistant editor. Like I never put that together, right? Like I will look at things in the project navigator, you know, and you know, shift clicked or alt click or alt shift click to you know, to get the bit open. And certainly I do the open quickly search one. I never realized you could do that, right? And it does work with the shift alt click, which will give you the option of, you know, adding a new tab or replacing the assistant editor, creating another assistant editor underneath. I use this, you know, these tools all the time. I literally had no idea you could do that specific thing. That saves a lot of time.
Alt click thing for years. In fact, I remember I showed it to Mark one time. I think we were doing a pair programming thing years ago. Remember that, Mark?
I don't remember that, but I believe it happened.
When you option click on a file in the project navigator on the side, it opens, you know, it uses that, what do they call it? It looks like the the Venn diagram, the assistant editor icon. It opens the side and puts it on the side by each for side by side comparison. So Jaime, you want me to blow your mind? Watch this. You got Xcode open?
I do not, but I can.
Open up any project you want.
Okay, well, it slowly opens. Oh, I don't know if it's an idea to open this one.
Can be anything, really. Something's got lots of, a few bosses in it.
Okay, let's see if this crusty old project opens. Okay,
we got it. You don't have to run it. You just have to be able to open it, right? So go to the search, you know, the Command Shift F to do search.
Okay.
Notice I didn't say Apple Key Shift F, but Command Shift F. And just look for the type of word in that you think will show up in the search.
Okay.
Right? You need to go click on the thing, click on it, and click on the result. And so now you're on a page inside your standard editor in the middle, which is the middle pane, right? But where is that in the project navigator, right? So if you hit Command Shift J on the keyboard, it'll open it in the project manager.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Cool, eh?
Oh, yeah, I actually do use that one. So
that's for the people driving at home.
Yeah, I think you were trying to amaze me. Unfortunately, you ran into one I actually do know and use all the time. But that's my point, right? Like you could keep watching, you know, here's some new thing in Xcode videos to the end of time. You would never run out. Because I knew these other ones, right? To Evan's one, I knew the open quickly, right? Shift command.
Yeah, I don't use the open quickly.
I knew about alt clicking from the from the project navigator. I didn't know I could combine these two things, and from the results in the shift command, I can get something into the assistant editor without having to round trip it through the Command Shift J option that you just reminded me of. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of my colleagues, Chris Wagner, was telling me about this thing, and he had posted it on Twitter. I think he might have pinned to his Twitter page, and I probably should go look at it. But you know, when you hold the command key down and you hover over top of a method declaration in your and you click on it, it gives you that jump to definition, and there's all this other crap that opens up, like show quick help, callers, edit and scope. In the old version of Xcode, it used to just jump to that definition. Do you remember?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? There's a way to turn off all this other junk, right? So it says here, what does it say? Command this?
Yeah, certainly for me, I like using it to understand like any documentation that there might be. If that's not enough, I need to see the source, you know, command clicking and getting to it. I think the biggest stumbling block for me is if you're using Swift and SourceKit decides that it needs to re-index before you get any syntax highlighting. That's the only sort of frustrating part. And that's more of a Xcode tooling thing than it is Swift specific.
Right, right.
I like using option click because that will open up the actual documentation.
Yeah, it also, if you option click, it'll also show you, if you click on a variable, it'll tell you whether it's an optional or not, or what type it is. And you know that one?
I don't know that one.
Like I'm looking at self-navigation bar top item, for instance, right? If I option click on navigation bar, it shows me that it's a var navigation bar of type UI navigation bar, and it's got an exclamation meaning it's force unwrapped, which of course it is. I can see like two lines above where it's declared, but yeah.
Okay, here's one here for you that I'm requesting or asking.
Yeah.
Is there a keyboard shortcut that does this? Because I know how to do it in two different ways from the UI, but using the mouse is not the most efficient way. So if I have my cursor on, let's say like a method declaration.
Sure.
And if I want to see who calls this, I can go to a couple different things.
Oh,
I can
either callers one, yeah.
Yeah, I can either right click, and then from the menu, I can use find call hierarchy. That'll do a search, and it will show me like, here's everybody who calls this and those callers and so on and so forth until it goes out of scope for everything. You can also use the little like Windows icon. It's like four squares next to each other, the related items, and choose from that menu the callers list and then individually go to one of these. Yeah. Is there a keyboard shortcut that just sort of does the find call hierarchy thing? Because that would save me a lot of time.
Yeah, that one I don't know. Let's see. Callers.
If anybody out there does know, hashtag AskMTJC, give some follow up. I'd sure love to know, because again, Xcode is so big.
When you're listening to this show, you can tell us what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Jack's one of the guys at Ray Runner that has done the tips and tricks, and I can't remember who did the last one. Those guys. Yeah, there was actually at RWDevCon, I mean, if you go back to the videos, there was a tips and tricks session, which I didn't go to, but that would have learned some cool stuff if I had.
They can have a totally different one next year, and there'll be also more cool stuff to know from Xcode.
Well, I told you about Command Shift G, which is the one that'll run the test that you just ran again without having to go back to your test buses, right?
You're talking about Control Option Command G?
Is that what it is? Control, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and Control Option Command U,
right, runs
which will run whichever specific test or test suite that your cursor happens to be in.
Exactly. Yep. Not that anybody does any test-driven development these days, right?
Test-backed development. That's the new hotness. There'll be test-backed development. That'll be the new hotness. There'll be conferences. There'll be swag to buy, you know, enamel pins, t-shirts, books.
TBD.
Coursera courses.
Yeah,
yes, we'll have DVD versions because you never know when somebody, you know, maybe you're on a trip, you know, family road trip. It's the summertime and you need to go out to a cabin or you're driving from Pennsylvania to Idaho and you got to do something with your time. You can't just be watching Shrek 3 on a loop. You got to do something for you. Keep your sanity.
Actually, I do have a stealth pick too, actually, now that you mentioned it. It came from our friends over at Topology Eyewear. You know, those shifty guys over there, right? It's on their blog.
You mean the mad scientist with the laser beams?
Yeah. Alexis Gallagher had posted a piece, and I was reading it today or yesterday, I think, actually. I'm just trying to find it right now. But it basically is how to build auto layout and things like that, a UI, view debugging and stuff like that using Playgrounds. Did you see that piece?
I did not.
Developing UI views in Xcode Playgrounds. And it's got a whole bunch of tips and tricks on how they use Playgrounds at Topology Eyewear to figure stuff out. It's a really interesting article. And then some example Playgrounds you can download. I'm just going to paste it into the show notes for you guys. That's my stealth pick. But I do have an actual pick too. Oh, there's Dick. Take a look at that one. I think it was liked by Greg, but it was written by Alexis. So cool stuff. So my actual pick is, I have to admit, this is a $20 video that just came out. It's an app documentary called App: The Human Story. And it's all about the sort of development of, or the history of app development in the last little while, talking to actual people who were involved in the sort of app sort of market and covers, you know, had the early successes and then, you know, the indie apocalypse. And it's kind of the history of our business or what this podcast is about over the last few years. And I think it's a little $20 investment to buy this video and watch it. But it looks pretty cool. I watched the trailer the other day, and I thought I would throw it in here as my pick for something that's of interest. I mean, Mark and I have even talked about writing a history of. I think we talked about writing a history of app development, in the last little while. But really cool story about how we've gotten to where we are today. Sort of from all the sort of ways that apps are now, apps and phones, things like that, are all affecting us and changing our lives, right? So, App: The Human Story. That's my pick this week.
Yeah, I've not seen this, but I think I heard that it includes a lot of folks that we would know. Brent Simmons, I think pretty well known in the Apple ecosphere, currently works at Omni here in the Seattle area. Did a lot of things like, you know, Mars Edit originally and RSS Gator and a lot of other things that people have certainly used before. I believe, and I could be wrong here, I think friend of the show Kim Altberg comes out in this as well for one of his apps. So it'd be interesting to watch and see kind of like, oh, who do we know here beyond just the, you know, the human interest part of the story. Not I know, sure. I don't come out in it because they didn't videotape me unless they did it surreptitiously.
Yeah, I don't know if I said $20, but it's actually $19.20 Canadian, so I suspect it's around $14-$15 US. So what does it say on your site, your version?
Let's see, where's the purchase? Is this direct download? Let's see here. Purchase via Vimeo. It doesn't even tell me how much. What? Yeah, I need to sign in first. All right, let's see what the DVD and Blu-ray is. Oh, on DVD, it's $5 on sale.
What? On DVD?
On Blu-ray, it's $5 on sale. I might get this in physical media version, and then when I'm on a road trip, I can put this in the van.
Oh, Blu-ray DVD, look at that. Huh. But is it actually been manufactured yet? I guess that's a question, right?
It's got a comment here. We had a small run, and the printing is not up to our standards, so these are deeply discounted.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're quoting, Gruber's quoted on this, and a few other people. Yeah, neat story. And it talks about, like, you know, how we sort of thought, you know, the app world was going to be great, and then turns out the majority of people just want to play Candy Crush all day kind of thing, right? And the big guys swooped in and, you know, wrecked it for the rest of us, right? I think part of the gist I got from the preview. Interesting stuff. All right, well, I guess that's it, for the week. I mean, if people want to find you on the intro, where they look?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithhair.
All right, and Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
Mark R. at smapsoft.com.
And I apologize for not asking you first.
Next week.
Next week I'll ask you. Yeah, maybe I won't. I don't know. We'll have to see. Yes. As I usually say, my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine. That's the best way to get hold of me. And don't forget, we sold a t-shirt today. You should get a t-shirt. Totally get a t-shirt. And if you don't want to get a t-shirt, go to San Francisco or San Jose, find Mark and get a t-shirt. But until next week, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Brenda the Show Jonathan. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at @mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag #AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Now stick around for the after show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I'm still torn as to whether I should buy an Apple Pencil or if I should just wait like two more weeks to see what happens at Dub Dub.
I'm still waiting.
See if they announce one or see if they hint at a new one coming out.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's a thing, like, you know, I find that I've been looking to see if I should buy like an Apple Pro keyboard, you know, and I keep looking at them, and I saw one the other day on Amazon for like $180, which is like, you know, a few bucks less than buying it retail. I still haven't pulled the trigger on it, you know. And again, but have I gotten by without using a keyboard on the iPad? Yeah, for sure. You know, and my pencil, I just charged my pencil up just before the show. I hardly ever use it, so I don't know. I would wait. I think yeah. unless you're going to use it pretty much every day or whatever, you know, you're really into it, then, you know, I'd wait.
Yeah, I think I probably will wait. It'll come in handy doing like whiteboarding or diagramming remotely.
Yeah.
I've tried using the paper app by hand, and it's got some tools that help, but it's definitely kind of frustrating to try to write text and draw seamlessly with my finger rather than using a pencil.
Paper's my favorite one for taking notes. Like when I open the paper app, I grab the felt pen or whatever, and I zoom in, you know, like I zoom in on the page, and then I basically just take notes, and I scroll around on the page and stuff like that. But that, I think of all the sort of apps that let me draw or, you know, sort of write cursively or whatever, that's probably my favorite one. You know, still haven't gotten to the whole sketching and painting yet, you know, on mobile devices, you know.
I think that's something a little bit different. That's kind of more in line with like what Tammy's doing, right?
She does it every day though, right? So
yeah,
she's been doing it for years too. The other thing that's really cool though, I have to say, AstroPad is amazing. Like if you use your Mac at all, like if you ever do any or want to do any drawing or whatever, like if I'm ever working on Photoshop and I have to get to do some close cutting and stuff, like I actually had to blur the background in that picture of Jonathan and Xavier. You know, normally I would open up AstroPad and I would zoom in on it, and then I could, you know, see the edges really well and use my pencil instead of just my finger, or even my finger on the trackpad, you know. So it'd be cool, you know, it'd be cool is if they came out with a trackpad that you could use a pencil on, you know what I mean?
Not a Wacom tablet, but like I guess Wacom makes out those too.
Yeah, so I've seen trackpads where, I mean, like people, I think the whole idea of drawing on an iPad or drawing on a Wacom tablet or the Wacom Cintiq is it's closer to drawing, but there's no reason why if you study drawing at all, you learn that, you know, like, you know how touch typing, when you're touch typing, I don't know if you touch type or not, but you don't look at your fingers, you look at the words on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
When you draw, you don't necessarily look at you're looking at the thing you're drawing and your hands are moving, kind of thing, right? So because you can see the cursor on the screen, you don't necessarily have to like be drawing right on the natural surface, right? So there's no reason why they couldn't make a trackpad that was, you know, that you could use the pencil with and then use that, I think, you know, use it for touch sensitive and stuff like that, like kind of work, right? Because, you know, if they built in the technology, it would read the sensor readings from the pencil, which is what they're doing on the iPad, right? And I've seen other softwares that have come out over the years that let you use your trackpad as, you know, as a tablet kind of thing, right? Drawing and stuff like that on in the past. But I think these trackpads are higher resolution than you'd think, right? In terms of how sensitive they are.
Yeah. And presumably the newer MacBook Pros with the enormous one have even more space there.
Well, so I have the Magic Trackpad 2 in my hand right now. It's like 4 by 6 inches, I guess. That's how big the trackpad is on the MacBook, Touch Bar MacBook, right? It's the same size. So it's ginormous. Yeah. I'm waiting for the OLED screen trackpad, Magic Trackpad 3 with HomePod integration, which will never happen.
And it tells time.
And makes phone calls.
Yeah.
Exactly. Two things we don't do anymore, tell time or make phone calls. Yeah.
So Tim, the Expanse, potentially saved by Amazon. They might bring it onto their service.
Is that for sure or not?
I don't think it's official yet, but they're in the works or in talks.
Wow.
That's good, right? I mean, we talked about, what was that other show?
Dark Matter.
Dark Matter that unfortunately didn't get picked up, but it looks like that. Well, I mean, but in like the modern social media era, yeah, right, where, yeah, you know, yeah, the Expanse got resurrected and saved by its fans. I still continue to see people tweeting about the Expanse.
Have you ever watched it?
Never have, and was not going to, seeing as it was about to be canceled.
Oh, really?
And then now that it's potentially resurrected, I'm like, oh, okay, now it's worth watching because it won't end on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I watched it since the very beginning because, again, it was on space and it looked kind of cool, and I thought I would watch it. And, you know, I always give shows one or two episodes and see how it goes. And yeah, I've been watching that one since the very beginning. And it's from a technology point of view, it's much more accessible than a lot of the other shows, right? Because have you ever read the Foundation trilogy, Mark, by Asimov?
Sure, many years ago.
Yeah, you remember the first story, the very first Foundation story was about trucking across from one planet to another, like the early I think it was the whole, like, you know, like how do you get, you know, sort of the, you know, the Pony Express kind of thing. How do you get from, you know, one place to another? How do you get supplies back and forth? Well, in the Expanse universe, and there's no spoilers given away here, but, you know, Mars has been colonized and the Earth has been colonized and the Moon's been colonized. And so, and then there's people living out in the asteroid belt, which is, and they're called Belters, right? And so we've stepped off of Earth, but we haven't gone that far yet, right? And so now there's the three sides, the Belters, there's the people on Mars, and there's people on Earth. And it's basically about the struggle between the three of them. And that's the Expanse, I believe, right? I think that's where the name comes from, the Expanse, because it's sort of the distance between them. And it's, you know, there's a whole politics and, you know, there's a character who's the leader of the Earth, of the United Nations, which is the leader of Earth and Mars. You know, they don't like each other and they're fighting and, you know, that kind of stuff, right? So it's not like all out war like Klingons versus the Federation, but, you know, there's tension and there's technology that gets, you know, that's there, and the Belters are sort of, you know, on the outskirts, you know, outliers in a sense, right? So, and it's very pretty, like it's very well, it's not cheesy graphics, is, you know, the graphics is really well done, and the CGI effects, and, you know, it's very believable from a point of view of where you think we might be in, say, 200 or 300 years, right? And I think that's the appeal of it, right? It's sort of, it looks good, it's got some interesting characters and some weird technology, of course, you know, because it wouldn't be sci-fi without weird technology. No spoilers given. And it starts out as a sort of private eye detective story, right? And then it goes from there. Definitely worth watching, even if it does get canceled, you know.
Well, that's why I didn't invest into Dark Matter, because I learned that it does end on a cliffhanger, and not like, oh, well, you can just imagine something happens sort of cliffhanger. It sounds like it's like, no, they really needed like a wrap-up episode kind of
thing. I don't know. I mean, so the premise behind Dark Matter is interesting, because, you know, it's about these six people that wake up on this ship and they can't remember anything, right? They've had their memories wiped somehow, right? And you know, and they don't even know their own names, so they call themselves 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, right? And then there's a robot as well, or an android, they call the android, right? And they can't and so the throughout the episode, it was on for 3 years, right? They kind of reveal little bits about people, and there's only one or two guys who actually learn their real names, right? And then there's mystery behind, because they weren't all, you think they're all in this together kind of thing, but it turns out over time that some of them are from different factions, and, you know, some were saboteurs and that kind of stuff, and how they all ended up on the ship together is the sort of mystery. That's the sort of lost in space kind of, you know, premise that never gets revealed, right? So it was a Canadian sci-fi movie, I think it was called Cage or something like that, where a cube, no, it was called Cube. Have you ever heard of the movie called Cube?
Yeah, I've seen Cube.
Yeah, you basically, these people wake up on this, in this cube, and then they kind of, you go through these different rooms and they find each other, and they're all trying to get out of the cube kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's very sort of Twilight Zone in that sense. They're trying to figure out where they are, why they're here, and how to get out of here, right? The Star Lost TV show was kind of like that too, right? Where these people wake up after suspended animation and they can't remember why they're, where they're going or what's going on. And, you know, it's that sort of mystery in that sense, right? So Dark Matter is very similar in that same sort of vein as Cube and the Star Lost, right? I don't think they really ever had to answer those questions, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like in Firefly, you want to find out where, what's her name? River and her brother, you know, you want to find out what their story is and so on and so forth, right? And they try to answer that question in the movie Serenity. Try not to put spoilers out there for people who haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, I think these shows that have a premise that's based on some sort of mystery are almost certainly going to be in a better place on a streaming service that can, you know, either buy the whole production run and say, all right, there's going to be a 5-season thing, you know, we're we're going to run the entire thing, run through your plan.
Mm-hmm.
Or if things have to get cut short, like let's say like Sense8 that had, you know, one season, then they kind of had like a long production break. They had some struggles. Yeah. It got out a second season and then it got canceled. But because there was enough fan interest, I said, all right, we'll make a 2-hour, you know, finale, you know, for the fans. And that would never happen on broadcast television, right? Like,
yeah.
Sci-Fi is cutting The Expanse and they're just cutting it hard. And this is why the fans were up in arms that, please, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Disney, somebody somewhere save us.
Yeah, I mean, broadcast television is so fickle. I mean, like, you know, it's like anything that's like sort of way out there, like if it's not a cop show or a fireman show or a bunch of guys and a bunch of girls living in these apartments together, you know, whether it's Seinfeld or Friends, you know what I mean? It's or it's like a soap opera kind of thing or a sitcom, you know, they're really tough to sort of like get these shows that are at that. And that's why things like Netflix and Hulu and that kind of stuff that can pick up these oddities and run with them, right? You know, like the science fiction section of a bookstore, to you and me, that's like gold, right? But to most people, mm-hmm. the majority of people out there, like that's such a small percentage of what they'd be interested in, right? They want to read the Harlequin romances or the, you know, the nonfiction bios and stuff like that, right? Or nonfiction bios and the biographies and things like that, right? Or the theories. They don't want to go into the corner of the bookstore and, you know, read the sort of sci-fi fantasy stuff, you know, which we, of course, you know, eat up, right?
Yeah, it's also a little different too with regards to syndication. Like, let's take two shows, competitive shows that came out this year that I think they work really well on, you know, where they're at in terms of broadcasting. So The Orville is a very episodic show, like TNG. There is some continuity from episode to episode, but if you came in at episode 7 and you watched episode 2, you're totally fine.
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to Star Trek Discovery, which would be an absolute disaster in normal syndication where they run them out of order, because you'd see all sorts of stuff and you'd have no clue what's going on. Like, you have to watch that as a serialized thing, and it plays better on a streaming service. Not one I'm happy paying for, but it's better in a streaming service than it would be on Fox, like The Orville is.
Right, yeah. But the other thing, what I mean, though, about fickleness is that, you know, the whole the model of ratings, right? The Nielsen ratings or whatever they use these days. I mean, like, if you look at it from a ratings perspective, The Big Bang Theory should have got canceled after the first season, right? Because, you know, Carol and I watched it and we didn't know anybody else who watched it. You know, maybe one or two people, right? But now it's like, you know, it's everywhere. People are watches it all the time. And they say part of that is because it went to syndication, but you have to have 100 episodes before they go to syndication, or they used to have that many, right? But you know, that was such an outlier show. In fact, you know, I think Mark sent me the original pilot episode to watch, and it's pretty out there in terms of a show that people would want to watch, right? So, you know, because the character's very undeveloped, and, you know, Penny wasn't even in the original one, right? So, yeah, but I mean, you know, again, like, I can't watch any more doctor shows or cop shows or fireman shows, you know, because that's all that, you know, or, you know, yeah, you know, there's like 10 different cop shows, and, you know, there's family dramas because their family's all in the, you know, they're all police people, and, you know,
like, CSI East LA. It's like, East LA? Is there a West LA show? Each zip code has their own CSI show.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's kind of dumb that way, right? So, but, and that's why something that's odd and an oddball show, like again, in Canada, if we didn't have the Space Channel, you know, there would be nowhere for this stuff to run, right? We do have also Showcase, Showcase here in Canada is very similar in terms of the kind of shows that you see on Showtime. And then, of course, we both get FX, right? You know, those are shows that are kind of like, they're more specialty channels, right? But it's funny, though, like some of these things like AMC, whatever, they're constantly showing, you know, the movie about the tornado with Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton, and Independence Day keeps getting shown over and over again. And like, do these people not realize that we've they're not fooling anyone by showing the same movie week after week after week after week, you know?
I mean, if you paid for that license, you're going to run it into the ground, right?
Well, like, yeah, I suppose.
Oh, is it Memorial Day weekend? Guess what? Harry Potter marathon on ABC Family.
You know, and if you look at it from the point of view of what I'm paying per month for the TV shows that I get, like, you know, I'm probably paying like a couple of bucks a month for these, you know, rare shows, these odd channels, right? But, you know, it's because they're all part of the package, as it were. I don't know if that's how TV is done for you guys, but if you have a cable package, you get like a couple of sports channels and a couple of arts channels, and you get all the regular, you know, networks that you used to get for free, you know? Is that what it's like for you down there?
Yeah, and, you know, with all of this, like, like fragmentation of streaming, it's getting kind of difficult. Because like, let me tell you about a series that I want to watch, and I could watch the first two episodes for free, but I refuse to pay for another service until I can find a reason to justify it.
Yeah.
That's Cobra Kai, which is the follow-up to The Karate Kid. This is on YouTube Red, so it's part of their premium service, and they have the first two, you know,
is that with Ralph
first
Macchio
hit is free.
So?
Yeah, Ralph Macchio and the dude who played Johnny, like they both come back as, you know, they're 20-some years older, 30-some years older, whatever it is.
And the Ralph Macchio character is the dick in it, right?
Yeah, yeah, I kind of, I don't know, maybe it says something about my personality, but I'm like, I'm kind of rooting for, you know, the Cobra Kai folks, and I'm kind of, you know, in the new Star Wars films, I'm kind of rooting for the First Order, and hashtag Thanos was right from Avengers Infinity War. Like, I find the villain side of it so much more compelling, at least right now. I don't know if I'll change in the future, but...
Yeah.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.